You know, we don't officially start until 5 past. And then at 5 past, for the benefit of the microphone, I'm going to say we're going to start. But since we're here, we may as well, we may as well at least start with some questions or something. I'll just mention a couple of things, if I may. I have some stuff at the back if people wanted this. There's a copy of my latest quarterly review on markets. And there's something else. I'm not quite sure what it is, but there's something about... Oh, there's a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, if you're interested. You know, if you sign up for the newsletter, we'll send you 3 or 4 samples, and then if you want to subscribe, subscribe, and if you don't, that's fine. That's at the back, and you can do that afterwards. I also have 2 cards here, if anybody wants it. One's an information... You know, one is for us, for our money management. So if you're interested in our money management, just fill this out and give it back to me. If you have any questions, just jot them on the back. And now the other one, as you know, our firm is the sub-advisor to Peter Schiff's Gold Fund, Euro Pacific Gold Fund. So if you're interested in information on the Gold Fund, I have a card from Peter that you can fill out. But I should note that's not Euro Pacific is not our firm. We just manage the Gold Fund. But if you're interested in that, you can fill it out. And before we start, I was just telling someone, you know, the fund is available directly from Euro Pacific, or you can also buy it on several platforms, and I'm honestly not sure what all the platforms are. But certainly you can buy it on TD and on Schwab, certainly, and a lot of other firms as well. The symbol, I mean, you just buy it like a normal stock, and the symbol is EPGFX. Euro Pacific Gold Fund, and then X for open end. One second, sorry. And there's no load if you buy it from discount brokers. If you buy it directly from Euro Pacific, there is a load. But if you're interested just in receiving more information about it, you can fill that out. Yes, sir, sorry. Yeah. No, the fund's done very well this year. I'll be honest, one of Frank Holmes's funds, I don't know if you know Frank Holmes, he's not there this year, but you know, Frank Holmes has been in the business a long time, and he has some good funds, but he has about 4 resource funds, and one of them is actually the top performing fund this year. It's up about 125%. We're second. We're up around 115%, and then all of the others are less than 100. So, yeah, we've done pretty well. But I have to admit that one of Frank Holmes's funds is outperforming us. But I did kid Frank. I said, if you take all your gold funds and get the average performance, then we're beating you, Frank. But anyway. Okay, is it 5 past yet? Because I've got to officially start at 5 past. What? 8:01. I should get a new watch, shouldn't I? Okay, so if anybody has any questions, and we'll just, and then at 8:05 I'll officially start. Anyone got a question? Yes, sir. Yeah. No, not really. No, why don't I follow that anymore? We did make money on it. It's a very difficult stock to follow. There's not a lot of information available on it. It wasn't a very good trader. It's on my watch list, but... I should look. Thank you for that, because I should look at that again. You know, frequently, if I buy something, and my experience is it's just difficult to trade. You know, the volumes aren't good. You put orders in, and the stock price runs away from you. I just decide, and of course, you have to buy it on the OTC. Certainly, I don't buy it directly in China. And the OTC is just such a lousy market. I bought it just because it was so cheap on assets. But, you know, I do, even though I buy a lot of very small stocks and a lot of very thinly traded stocks. I still like something where, how can I put it, the trading is honest. If it's bid 10, if it's 10 by 12, I can actually sell it at 10, not at 8 or 7. You know what I mean? We held on until the takeover, 100%. I mean, we were buying even a week before the takeover. We were adding to positions all the way up. But you're asking, are we keeping Nipson? That's a long answer, probably. Do many people here own Nevson? Because you would own Nevson if you owned Reservoir. And if you were here last year and you didn't buy Reservoir, what shall I say? I don't know why I'm standing up here talking, and I don't know why you're sitting down there listening if you didn't buy Reservoir after last year. But was that polite or was that impolite? Well, you can tell me, Jim. You're a friend. No, I don't mean to be rude, but you know what I mean. So Nevson is a tricky company. What I've done is I've reduced clients' positions to what I would regard as a more normal position. I'm sorry, we need to start, so let me start, and then why don't you ask the question again, and then we'll be... You can answer it very quickly, because I'm going to repeat it for the microphone. Okay, so it's now 8:05, so we're going to begin our workshop. This is Adrian Day. We're going to be talking about some of my top picks, both dividend-paying stocks as well as some resource stocks, and then what I'd like to do is keep that fairly brief and leave a lot of time for questions. But I know one gentleman here had a question that perhaps we'll start with. Yeah. So let me repeat the question for the tape. The gentleman said we were heavily invested in Reservoir Minerals, which is correct, and the company was taken over by Nevson Minerals. Have we held on, or what's our position on Nevson? Reservoir for us was one of those very, very rare stocks that only comes along once in a while. Virginia was one. Diamond Fields was one before that. A stock where you know ultimately the company is going to get taken over. It's just obvious. The deposit is too good and it's too big for the company involved, so you know it's going to get taken over. And it's one of those rare cases where we were buying all the way up. So we were buying Reservoir, as I mentioned, just even the last week before the takeover. We had clients who were on any prudent basis grossly overweighted in Reservoir. So when the takeover happened, the first thing we did was reduce positions to more normal size positions for a stock like Nevson. For an aggressive account in resources, that might mean 10%. For a more conservative account, it might mean 3% or nothing. Some clients, we sold all of it. You know, if they were conservative clients, we sold it all. So let's look at Nevson a second. But we still own an awful lot of Nevson, an awful lot. Nevson, as you probably know, has a... Let's do the good and the bad. Nevson has a mine in Eritrea, which is a world-class deposit, generating enormous cash, free cash flow. It has been a very good mine since they built it. Nevson are very good operators. They built the mine. They built the... It's a mine that started with a copper gold. It had a sort of gold cap, and then it was copper gold to begin with. Then it went purely... In the second phase, it went purely copper. And in the third phase, it's moved from copper into zinc. It's an interesting deposit. And so on the first, on the initial build, as well as the copper expansion, as well as the zinc circuit that they've just completed, they've built all three within time and under budget, which is extremely rare. So they've got a good track record there and a very good track record at operations. Okay, so that's the sort of good news. They've got a great balance sheet. After paying for Reservoir, it's probably about $50-60 million US. They've got free cash flow, so they're earning more money. It was up at about 150 at one point, but they built, I mean, that's another great thing. They built the whole zinc expansion with their own cash. They didn't have to go to the market at all because of a great balance sheet. So that's good. And they pay a dividend of nearly 5%, which comes out of free cash flow, which is also very unusual for a mining company. The other really good thing is that they just bought Reservoir. Reservoir is a great deposit. I personally think that Nevsun stole it. I think it was very, very cheap. Those of you who own the company might know that I was involved in a rear guard action that got at least an extra $2 for us. But it's still, they got a good buy. So there's a lot of potential in that deposit. And they just released some results last week that were spectacular results, spectacular. So that's all of the good news. I mean, the bad news is that they're in Eritrea. And Eritrea is, not exactly the flavor of the month. They don't have any operational issues. You know, the government is a partner, and the government is supportive. But it's a country where, you know, Nevsun's affiliation with Eritrea makes it very difficult to raise capital. You know, most banks, most international development banks, most private banks won't lend money to a company involved in Eritrea. They're being sued in Canada now on the accusation that they employ slave labor, that the government, the government supplies them with forced labor to work in the mine. So they have had some people shot on site in the early days. So it's not a nice place, and the guy that runs it is basically a thug. So, the country, not the company. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. there's no question at all that if the Bisha mine, it's called the Bisha mine, if the Bisha mine were located in another country other than North Korea or Sudan, the stock would probably be double or triple what it is now. It's very, very, very undervalued if you simply looked at the asset. But Eritrea is a big, big question mark. And they bought Reservoir. I'm not going to answer this on every question, but I know a lot of people own a lot of it. They bought Reservoir, whose deposit is in Serbia, as a way of diversifying out of Eritrea and improving their political risk profile. Now, there aren't too many companies where you can buy into Serbia and actually improve your risk profile. The idea was that the hope was that it would kind of diminish the Eritrea discount that they have. What unfortunately seems to have happened is the opposite. The people that own Reservoir are now upset that, you know, they're associated with Eritrea. So that's a long, long answer. So, I mean, it's a great company. Very undervalued. Timok the Reservoir property has huge potential. It pays a dividend. It's got free cash flow. So we're holding on to some for clients, but it really depends on the client, to be honest. I wouldn't be surprised, and this is just I don't know if this should be on tape or not. This is purely a guess on my part. It's speculation on my part. I wouldn't be surprised if Nevsun eventually were to either spin out Reservoir again or sell the whole company to someone else who then spins out Reservoir. Because in my view, that Reservoir deposit is worth almost the entire market cap of Nevsun. So if you take the value of the reservoir deposit, the value of reservoirs exploration, they've got exploration JVs with Rio Tinto and other major companies, as well as the actual deposit they have, plus you add the cash that Nevsun has, I think you're getting Bisha basically for free. So I think I wouldn't be surprised if they spin it out again. Anyway, that's a very long-winded answer. I'm awfully sorry. Why don't I just mention a few companies that I like, and then should we throw it open for questions? I think at this time of night people like questions, yeah? I mean, I'm happy to talk, but... So it was promised that we... Oh, what's that? It was promised on the thing that we were talking about, high yield as well as potential 10-baggers. So let's just talk about high yield first. And there's really... two major areas where I like high yield now. You know, in an environment of very, very low yields, people are stretching for yield. So you have to be careful. And when something is offering an above market yield, you really have to ask yourselves very carefully why. Because normally companies that are offering above market yields are stocks that have problems and should be avoided. All right? But there's two areas where I think the yields are very, very attractive, and there are reasons, justifiable reasons for it. One area of the BDCs, I know everybody's heard me, well, if you've heard me before, you've heard me talk about the business development companies. How many people here are not familiar with business development companies? Okay, business development companies basically are U.S. companies that lend money to small and medium-sized businesses. They are structured as registered investment companies, and they do not pay tax at the corporate level if they distribute 94%, don't worry, if they distribute essentially all of their net income to investors as dividends. So they're like REITs, like real estate investment trusts, which distribute all of their earnings, so the yields tend to be high, right? Now, business development company is simply a structure. You can have aggressive ones, conservative ones. Some focus purely on technology companies. Others have zero technology, etc. A BDC is simply the structure we're talking about. The sector was very, very weak last year, and I think we talked about it last year, so I won't reiterate it all, but basically they were very weak last year for a couple of reasons. One was some absolutely asinine SEC rule that essentially forced any funds to sell, BDCs, because they had to double count the management fee. And it also led S&P and Russell to delete BDCs from their indices. So when S&P and Russell deleted the stocks from their indices, that caused people to panic. You know, what's going on? What's the problem? If you want, we can go into the details. They're kind of boring, but an interesting way looking at how the SEC views the world. The other reason was concern about higher interest rates. A misguided concern at higher interest rates will hurt these companies. On the contrary, the opposite has been shown to be true throughout history. First of all, these companies operate on a spread, right? So the absolute level of interest rates doesn't really matter. If they can borrow money, most of these companies can borrow money at 6 or 7%, if they can borrow money at 6 or 7% and lend it out to 12, 13, 14% to the private companies, these are all private companies they lend to private companies, they've got a great spread. All of the loans, virtually all of the loans of all of the BDCs are floating rate. So if rates start to move up, if rates move up 0.5%, 1%, it's not going to affect the ability of the companies to pay back the loan, but the interest payments are going to go up. Correspondingly, the interest rate they have to pay to borrow money will go up, but the spread will remain the same. So for that reason, interest rate hikes don't really hurt the companies. The second reason is that typically when interest rates start to move up, banks start to pull back from lending money to small businesses, although this is not a normal cycle. I don't think anyone can say that. And so when banks don't lend money to small businesses, BDCs are able to fill that gap. So that's the sort of basic story there. This year, they have recovered dramatically, because after the interest rate hike in December, people realized that that didn't really hurt the BDC sector, and the BDCs have recovered this year by as much as 30 to 35% across the board. Typically, when I see something that's up 35% in a year, I'm not particularly interested. But when you look at the valuations on these things, the valuations are still considerably below their historic norms. And let me just give you a couple of three very quick, I'll just mention three of them that I like right now. One is called Ares, ARCC. Ares is the largest of the dividend-paying BDCs. It's about a $6 billion market cap, and that's very large for this sector. Trading at around $15.35. The yield is 9.9%. And I need to emphasize that that yield is fully covered by their earnings. The NAV is 0.9%, so they're trading at a 10% discount to NAV. And this, the last few months, is the first time in this company's history that it is traded at a discount to NAV. One of the reasons that this stock is so cheap relative to the other sectors, one of the reasons is that they are acquiring another BDC called American Capital. Typically, as most of you probably know, it happens in the resource business. When Company A decides to buy Company B, right, at a premium, ARBs come in and they short Company A and they buy Company B, hoping that they can get an arbitrage, whatever happens. Stocks go up, stocks go down, but they'll make money on the arbitrage because they're long one, short the other. So the short interest in Ares is now pretty much at its historic high. What this means, of course, is that once the merger is complete in December, then the ARBs have to unwind their positions. And they will do that by delivering the American Capital stock that they bought against a short position and unwind that short position, which means that after the first couple of weeks, the stock price should start to move back up. But to me, the basic point is that if you can get 9.9% on a solid, conservative company, which is earning that dividend and has earned its dividend throughout its history, I wouldn't worry about short-term machinations, to be honest, or short-term volatility. The second stock is one called Munro, as MRCC, and Munro is trading just a tad over $15 a share. They both trade on NASDAQ, by the way. It's yielding 9.3% and is trading just around book, just a tad over book. So again, very cheap, fully earning its dividend, no particular problems in the portfolio. The market cap on this one, however, is $250 million. So, you know, once you take out Ares and a couple of other, you get down under $1 billion very, very quickly. Most of these stocks are very, very small. Some of the ones we own are only 100 and 150 million market cap. Some of the ones we own. So they're very, very small, which is one of the reasons these stocks tend to be so volatile. They are very, very volatile on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. And just to give you an example, Ares has been as high as, in the last 6 months, it has been as high as 1650, as low as 1250. And that wasn't just one time at 1650 and one time at 1250. It's been sort of up and down like a yo-yo. The third one that we own, a little more aggressive. So the first two are very conservative. The last one is Pennant Park, which is PNNT, Pennant Park. That's trading at about $7.65. Yeah, Paul Nancy Nancy, Tom. Trading at $7.65, the stock has actually doubled this year. But it's still remarkably inexpensive. The yield, if you're ready for this, the yield is 14.6%. So when we were buying it in February, we were getting a 20% dividend yield, which is pretty amazing. Why is the stock so cheap? One reason. They've got about 15% of their portfolio in loans to energy companies. And, you know, this is something that the market kind of focused on, which companies have loans to energy companies, which ones don't. Pennant has more energy loans than any other BDC, and the stock was severely punished for it. The really interesting thing is that energy, in the way they classify these things for registered investment companies, energy is a very, very broad classification. It includes everything from exploration and drilling companies to gas stations and to power stations. Everything is lumped into energy. So you have to look through a little bit and see, okay, so what do they have? The truth is that the companies that Pennant has loaned to are pretty small companies. But the truth also is that up until now, they have about five loans representing 15% of a portfolio. They have all fully, you know, they're all up to date on paying their loans back. If a company in the oil space can pay back its loans over the last 18 months, it's probably going to make it. The way I look at it, though, if you look at it on a purely fundamental basis, even if all of those five loans went bankrupt, right, and the rest of the portfolio just was okay, but that 15% of the portfolio went bankrupt, you've still got better than a 10% dividend yield. So, to me, you're not really taking too much risk in buying that. But I would have to say that even apart from the energy stocks, it is a riskier BDC than the other ones. They tend to invest in riskier companies, smaller companies, etc. Enough on that, I think, yeah? I'll just finish, and then if there's questions, we can have them all at the end. I think the second area that I'd look at would be Asian stocks. And again, in certain markets, I'm answering the question, well, why are the dividend yields so high? In certain markets, Hong Kong is one, dividend yields historically over 40 or 50 years have typically been higher than global averages. So, you look at the Hong Kong yields and you have to compare them, I think, with their historic averages, not what the U.S. stocks are paying at this particular time. And the same would apply to certain other markets. British stocks typically pay high dividends. German stocks typically trade very close to book value. So if you see a German stock at 2.5 times book, that is extremely expensive for that market. You need to ask yourself why. But if you see a Hong Kong stock trade with a yield of 6 or 7, it doesn't mean that the stock's any more aggressive than anything else. They just typically pay high dividends. So I'll say three that we like. One is Costco International. Some of you will probably know Costco. It's the shipping company based in Hong Kong. It's the largest. It's the largest shipping company from Hong Kong, China, from the east to North America. The symbol, let me just give you the symbol before I forget. The symbol is 517. In Hong Kong, they trade in numbers. So it's 517. I would always urge you, if you're going to buy a Hong Kong stock or a Singapore stock, and it's not listed in the U.S., or it doesn't have a sponsored ADR, I would always urge you to buy it in the local market, meaning Hong Kong or Singapore, not OTC, because the OTC market is just notorious for buying foreign stocks. And I'll give you an example of that in a second, if I may. Just to finish with Costco. So Costco is trading at $3.60 Hong Kong. It's trading at a 30% discount to NAV. It yields 3.6%. But here's the real key to it. The real key is Costco right now has virtually no debt, to all intents and purposes, no debt, and the stock is trading below the cash that it holds. The company, even in the bottom of this freight market, because as you may know, the shipping market is at a pretty low point right now, even at what's probably a trough for the shipping market, it's still making money every quarter. So it's making money, it has no debt, and the stock is selling for less than cash. And there is no sort of fatal flaw. It's not as though their ships are all terribly old and will need replacing pretty soon, or they're losing their contract, or anything like that. There's no fatal flaw. So if you're patient, I think you have to be patient and wait for the shipping cycle to turn, but if you're patient and wait for that cycle to turn, I think you could do very well, and the downside has to be, in my view, pretty limited when you're trading below cash and you're getting 3.5% dividend yield. Another one that we own in Hong Kong is a company, and we're buying, these are ones we're buying, is a company called Playmates Toys. And before you all wonder what that's about, they make actually children's toys, stuffed animals and things like that. Yeah, I know, it's kind of unfortunate. The symbol on that one is 869 Hong Kong. The price is $1.25. It yields over 8% and it's trading for less than 7x earnings, and it has zero debt on the balance sheet, absolutely zero debt on the balance sheet. Why is the stock so low? Simple. They have the rights to the Ninja Turtles. Mutants in there somewhere. Is mutant at the beginning or in the middle? Ninja Mutant. Thank you. Anyway, they have the rights to that thing. And of course, the film that just came out, was apparently bombed. And so when people saw, the stock had run up in advance of the film coming out in North America, the film bombed, so the stock collapsed, and it went down further than it did. I mean, obviously, I'm recommending it, so obviously I think it's just a gross overreaction. The company is making money even without the Ninja Turtles. They have no debt, and they're paying an 8% dividend yield. I think that's pretty attractive, and I think the stock will recover. The last one I like a lot is a Singapore stock called Kingsmen. Symbols KMEN, King Mary Edward Nancy. Sorry, King Mary Edward Nancy. Like. K-M-E-N, Nancy. K-M-E-N. Yeah. And Kingsmen is a really neat little company. They design and manufacture exhibits for stores, for museums, for festivals, for fairs, amusement parks, etc. They don't make any of the actual mechanics of the theme parks, but they make the designs around the rides. Their biggest sector is for store openings, which has been very, very big in China and Singapore in the last in the last 10 years. But a new store like Versace or someone will open a new store in Beijing. They'll put as much as $20 million into that store and into marketing it. And Kingsmen designs the store and the look of the store, and they manufacture the things that go in there. They also do a lot of one-off work, gosh, what's happening to me? It's late. What are those racing? Formula. The Formula One race was in Singapore, they did all the design work for the banners and the VIP stands and all that kind of stuff. Now, the reason I like it, it's a great business because, number one, they have very, very low fixed costs. Their highest fixed cost is the designers who work in Singapore. They're all staff employed in Singapore. The manufacturing is all piecemeal, and it's all based in Malaysia. So A, it's a lot cheaper than Singapore, but B, it's piecemeal. They simply hire people when they need to construct something. Secondly, they don't start construction on anything until the company has paid them a deposit. So if it's a $20 million contract, they want $10 million down, and then they construct the exhibit. So it's very, very low, very, very low fixed costs and very, very low risk, really, because everything is done to contract. They have essentially no debt. Stocks trading at 62 cents Singaporean, which is about 45 cents US. Yields 4.8% and is trading under 8 times price earnings. Company's just done very well. If you look back at their 10, 15-year track record, earnings have gone up year after year after year. I mean, it's just a great business because it's so low risk and virtually no fixed costs. They own their own building in Singapore, so the only fixed costs they have are the employees who do the design. I was going to mention, just to give you an example, Kingsmen, 62 cents in Singapore, trades hundreds of thousands of shares a night. You know, if you want to buy it, you can put in an order with a limit, and if it's a reasonable order, you'll get filled. It hasn't traded in the OTC market for about 3 weeks now. The price is something like 40 cents by 52, so that's a 25% spread. And I will guarantee you, that if you put in an order to buy it at 52, 10,000 shares, you'll get 100 and it'll move to 54. That's the way the OTC market works. So that's the reason I just plain don't like the OTC market. And if you put in a limit order on that market, the only time you get filled is when the stock collapses in Singapore, and then they'll fill you. But they're still filling you at a much higher price than the prevailing market price is. It really is it's close to a ripoff. But I would always buy on the local market, even if that means going to a broker where you have to, you know, pay a ripoff commission. I was going to name an example, but I shouldn't since this has been recorded. But let's just say you can, I mean, any of you who have foreign accounts, whether they're in Europe or in Asia, you can buy these stocks on the local market, no problem. Rick Rule's firm, Sprott, they will buy stocks for you on pretty much any foreign market that you want. Now, they do charge a full commission, but you can see from the example I've given, if you can buy that at 44 cents U.S., and pay a $100 commission, that's better than paying 54 cents and paying a $9 commission and winding up not buying the stock anyway. So I always recommend going to a broker that can buy these things on the local market. So that's that. There's no in Singapore. Singapore is a very weird market because there are the symbols. You know, everybody uses different symbols. I'm sorry, but the sort of traditional symbol is KMEN. That is the symbol. They don't use numbers in Singapore, so it's KMEN in Singapore. Let me just mention a couple of the gold stocks that I like, and then we'll have a little bit of time for questions. And I'm going to discuss a couple that are here at the show. Osisko Gold is here, Osisko Gold Royalties. You know, I'm a big fan of the royalty companies. Anyone who's heard me speak before probably knows that. I mean, you don't have to give away private information, but let's ask a different question. And is there anyone here who doesn't know Franco-Nevada? Okay. You know, royalty companies essentially are companies that will, just in the oil business, a royalty company will give money to the mining company in exchange for a percent of their future production. The model's a good model because it means that they're not responsible for all the things that go wrong. So they don't have there's no risk beyond what they put up, of course. You know, if Franco buys a royalty for $300 million and the mine never produces, they've lost $300 million. But they never are responsible for putting more money up. An operating company can often find itself in the situation where it thought its CapEx was $800 million, but the CapEx turned out to be $1.2 million. That's not Franco-Nevada's problem. They can find that once they get digging down, they sort of find that the vein narrows and the production goes down. That's not Franco-Nevada's problem, because Franco-Nevada pays a certain amount of money for a certain percent of the ounces. So I like the royalty model a lot. One of the company, and Franco-Nevada, I would say, if you don't, you know, if you only own one gold stock, it should be Franco-Nevada, which is just a great company. It's got a $1.2 billion in cash. It's got about 40 producing royalties. It's got royalties on about 40 producing mines right now. It's got over 350 royalties in the pipeline. So with a stronger gold market, some of those will come on. FNV, Frank Nancy Victor, trades on New York as well as on Toronto. Frank Nancy Victor. And right now it's selling under $64. It's had a bit of a pullback. I think that's a very, very good price. If you don't own it, this is what we were doing for clients. Any clients we had that didn't own it, we bought it in the last week. It's a very good price to pick it up, I think. Osisko? Haven't got to that yet. But the symbol for Osisko is OR, Oscar Robert. Franco is a $6 billion market cap company. It's the best of the bunch, in my mind, by far. Osisko is the fourth largest royalty streaming company. Royal Gold is the second. Silver Wheaton, which focuses on silver and focuses on streams, not on royalties, is also large. And then Osisko is the sort of new one, the fourth largest and the newer one. It came about, Osisko actually discovered, built, and operated a mine called Malartic, and then there was a hostile takeover, and eventually the mine was sold to Agnico and Yamana, and Osisko retained a royalty. So they don't operate the mine anymore, they sold the mine, but they retained a royalty on that. They have four operating royalties, so 4 versus 40. You can see it's a lot smaller, a lot newer. And only two of those are what I would call real, substantial royalties. One on the Malartic, which was their mine, and then the other one's on Eleanor. Eleanor is a mine that was discovered by Virginia and eventually sold the mine was sold to Goldcorp and is now in production, and Virginia retained a royalty and has now sold itself to Osisko. So Osisko owns two great royalties, that's on Malartic and on Eleanor. They're both low-cost, long-life mines in Quebec, a very safe mining jurisdiction. They are two of the best gold royalties out there. So Osisko has several good things going for it. It has two great royalties. It has a very good pipeline of admittedly very early stage. It doesn't have another royalty that's in the developmental process. It's got a lot of royalties on very early stage land. It's got a great balance sheet, about $550 million, that's Canadian. So, and they've got good backing from the Quebec institutions. So they have a lot of good things going for them. Sean Rusin, who runs the company, is very aggressive. I don't think he's at the show, is he? I haven't seen him. He's a very aggressive mining entrepreneur. The downside is it's newer. It's less diversified, and one could argue that an aggressive personality is not exactly the personality you want running a royalty company, which is meant to be a low-risk way of getting exposure. It's also by far the cheapest on a valuation basis. It's the cheapest of royalty companies right now, partly deservedly so. It should be less expensive than Franco or Royal. It should be. But I think it's now discounted at a bit too much. So the symbol is OR on Toronto as well as New York. It trades on New York. It's had a little bit of a run this week. It's at about $10.50. I think that's a very, very good price to pay for it. I wouldn't pay up for it. I don't think you need to. But it's one you might have to hold a little bit longer. They pay a dividend, by the way, as does Franco. Franco pays, what, about 1.2%, I think, something like that. Not a lot, but they do increase the dividend regularly, and Osisko also pays a dividend, which they're committed to increasing every year. So I like Osisko a lot. One more. Medgold is a small company, and someone had asked me for a small company with lots of potential. Medgold is a small company. It's about a $12 million market cap. So, you know, bear that in mind. Quite thinly traded. It's trading at around 18.5 to 19.5 right now, cents Canadian. The symbol is, I'll get to the company in a second, the symbol is MED for Med. MED on Toronto. I should also say that our firm holds around 18% of the company right now for clients, so we're a big holder. Medgold has properties in Portugal. In fact, Dan James was on the panel yesterday. Did anybody hear him talk? Yeah. Dan James was on the panel. So they hold properties in Portugal as well as in Serbia. They did have properties in Italy and in Spain, but they made the strategic decision to drop those, and I think that was a good move on his part, and it goes to one of the things that was discussed at the panel. You know, just as shareholders have to know, investors have to know when to give up on a stock, explorers have to know when to give up on a property or a region or a country. And they decided pretty quickly to drop both Italy and Spain. But they retain Portugal. They have two properties in Portugal that are both joint ventured to Centura. Does everybody here know basically how a joint venture works? The exploration company finds a project, but they find someone else to come in and spend the money, and in return for spending the money, if the company meets certain spending hurdles over a certain number of years, you know, it might be $3 million over 3 years, they then get 51% of a project, and then they have the right to go up to 75% if they spend $5 million over the next 2 years, for example. That's just hypothetical. So someone else is spending the money, that's the key. So Centura has two JVs with them in Portugal. And then Fortuna Silver, I don't know how many of you are familiar with that company. I think it's one of the best silver companies, personally. But Fortuna, which is FSM, Frank Sam Mary on New York, FVI in Toronto. But they have a joint venture with them on a project, they have a strategic alliance at the moment on the ground in Serbia. And a strategic alliance is a little bit different from, I don't know if we want to go into, but a strategic alliance basically means that Fortuna is spending the money, Medgold is doing all the work, and every time they find something, Fortuna has a right to joint venture that project. So at the moment, they're just sort of doing grassroots exploration. But if they find something, Fortuna has the right to then enter into a joint venture on normal sort of terms that have already been agreed upon. So I think that's very, very attractive for a small company. Three projects with that are joint ventured, so they're not spending any money or spending very little money. And if they hit on one of these, given the size of a company, and given the, you know, very tight structure, over 50% of a company is owned by big shareholders like our clients, plus the management. So it's very tightly held. If they have success, it'll do very, very well. I'm going to quit there, I think, and see if there's any kind of questions. I'm happy to stay for a little while, but I hate to do this. I do have another appointment that I'm meant to, well, I'm going to be late for, but I'm meant to be at. That's 18.5 cents to 19.5 cents. You know, the truth is, if you put a bid in at 19, you'll probably get it. 19.5 is not a bad price to pay, but you just don't want to pay up. You don't want to force your own stock up because of your own buying. So 19.5 is a good buy. Yeah, MED, Mary Edward David. Correct, it doesn't trade US at all. I mean, it trades OTC. It only trades Toronto. It only trades Toronto, yes, sir. You know, the gentleman, I'm repeating the question for the tape. The gentleman asked about stop losses, specifically with Singapore and Hong Kong, but let me just address stop losses, if I may, in general. You know, there is no magic bullet. Stop losses, to me, are a perfectly valid tool if your objective is to limit high risk in a particular stock and you don't mind being whipsawed or giving up the upside in return for avoiding the big loss on a stock. The problem... But some people don't like, I don't particularly like stop losses, I'll be honest. I particularly don't like stop losses in junior gold stocks, and I don't like stop losses on foreign stocks. And the reason in particular for those, junior gold stocks are so volatile anyway. So when someone asks me to put stop losses on stocks, I say, okay, what do you want? Do you want a 10% stop? Do you want a 25% stop, or do you want a 50% stop? A 50% stop loss is hardly worth putting in. You've already lost half your money. But a 10% stop loss, I can guarantee you that on any of these stocks, I've got a list of 10 stocks here that are at the show that I like. A 10% stop, you'll be taken out within 2 days or 3 days just by normal daily trading. So it's always a difficult decision. A good example is Midland. Midland is one of my favorite stocks. It's at the booth. It's one of my very, very favorite junior gold stocks. That stock was trading at $1.20 2 weeks ago, and it went down to 92. What's that percentage? Can you work it out, Jim, quickly for me? Yeah. So if you had a 20% loss, you might have just escaped. But if you had a 15% loss, you'd be out, and the stock's now back at $1.20, you know, 2 weeks later. And the reason it went down was simply because someone exercised some 95-cent warrants and decided to exercise the warrants and sell the stock. And, you know, that happens all the time. Medgold, for example, it was up at 24 and it was down at 14. Well, any kind of stop you want to talk about would have got taken out on that. So I just don't think stop losses are practical for junior stocks. With foreign stocks, you can't play. I mean, the beauty of a stop, to me, the beauty of a stop loss for most people is they're automatic, right? You don't want to be in a position where you have a stop in your mind and then when it hits it, you sort of think about it. The whole point of a stop loss is automatic. Well, you can't use automatic stop losses on overseas stocks. So I, you know, I just think they're impractical there. Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay, the worst environment for BDCs, the worst environment is one of a fairly significant recession. Higher interest rates doesn't really affect them, as I just mentioned. But a recession, which is often caused by higher interest rates, so people think, oh, higher interest rates bad for BDCs. It's not the higher interest rates that are bad, it's a recession. Because in a recession, well, there's two scenarios. One is a recession, because in a recession, some of the companies that they've lent money to have difficulties and can't pay back the loans. Typically, if you look at the big companies like, say, Ares, you know, they have historically, over 20 years, they have less than 4% default rate, which isn't bad. It's certainly lower than the banks. The second... But that hurts them, and it hurts particularly the smaller companies just because they're less diversified. You know, if you've only got 15 companies in your portfolio and one of them goes belly up, you know, that affects you quite significantly. The second very important factor is in a credit crisis, a credit crunch, if they can't gain access to new capital, it means they can't grow. Now, not growing is not the end of the world, right? But typically, these companies, because they pay out all of their net earnings in... it's actually all of their net income. It's not net earnings. All of their net income is paid out in dividends. They have to gain new capital, either new equities or new debt or loans, in order to make new loans, right? Because if they sell one of their loans at a gain... they have to pay all that out. That all counts as operating income. So the only way that they can make new loans is by getting new capital. And if the capital's not available, then they can't grow. And sometimes you want to grow just to sort of cover mistakes that you've made in the past, if that makes sense. But to give you an example, a lot of the companies got into trouble in 2008. And one, for example, is a company called Gladstone Capital, which we own and we like. Gladstone Capital had a line of credit with Deutsche Bank. And Deutsche Bank, if you can believe this, gave them 7 days' notice that they would pull in the loan. And Gladstone was in a position, because they'd used half of the loan, they were in a position where they had to liquidate some of their investments on 7 days' notice to repay the bank, and they sold 5-year treasuries at a loss, which is something that a normal person would never need to do unless you just had to sell within a short period of time. So all of the companies have learned from that, but a credit crisis would certainly hurt them, no question. Yes. Quick update on Altius. I can't do anything quick, as you know. But, Altius I love. For those who don't know it, Altius is a royalty company. It's a really interesting company. They do exploration, grassroots exploration, but always with a view to generating a royalty. So typically what Altius does is they generate projects, they bring in partners, and when the project is of a certain substance... they try to spin off that project into a separate private company, retaining shares in the public company, plus a royalty. And that's a simplified version of the company. No, I like Altius a lot, and one of the things that they have been very, very good at over the years is in their timing of the resource cycles, because resource business is extremely cyclical, as you know. Now, they made a big mistake in hanging on to their iron ore too long, and they had a big investment in iron ore, very attractive deposit with a very attractive royalty, but it's of no value because the mine was never built. So they hung on to that too long. But typically, they have been very good at knowing when to do JVs, when to go public with companies, when to sell resources, and when to buy resources. And what they've been doing in the last 3 or 4 years is building an enormous land bank, primarily in Eastern Canada, not just Newfoundland, but Eastern Canada, in Chile, in Poland, and in Ireland. And they've built an enormous land bank in all of those four jurisdictions, and they were building that land bank for virtually nothing because it was in a bad market when people were giving stuff away. Now the market is turning. They're beginning to do some JVs on some of those projects. They've already done a couple of JVs on the Chilean projects, copper projects. And I think over time, over a year or two or three, you'll see them do more JVs with the land they built, the package they acquired, and over 5 or 6 or 7 years, they'll be able to harvest that with companies going public, with mines being built, and so on. So I think it's a this price. We're not buying it now, to be honest. It went under $10. We were buying very aggressively under $10. We own about 3.5% of the company. It's now a little over 11. I think it's still cheap. I wouldn't dream of selling it, but you know, it tends to be a volatile stock, so I'd wait for a pullback. ALS, Adam, Larry, Sam, on Toronto. The symbol down here is ALTUS. ATUSF. Adam, Tom, Unicorn, Sam, Frank. And it's not a bad trader down here. So if you use a discount broker, it's not a bad trader down here. You could buy it, as long as you use a limit. The liquidity is better in Toronto, but it's not bad down here. If you don't own it, I frankly, if you don't own it, if you're new to this space and you're looking for, you know, 5, 6, 10, you know, really good companies, large and small, if that's your scenario, you know, you've just got $1 million and you've got no exposure to resources, I would buy Altius today. But, you know, when you own 3.5% of it, you're looking for lower prices before you add to it. Yeah. Any other? Yes, sir. Ten that I like. Did I say that? Oh, 10 I like on the... Oh, 10 baggers. Sorry, that means companies whose stocks... Oh. Oh. No. No. If you either give me a card or fill out a form or something, the form for the newsletter, we can send you the newsletter which lists some of the stocks that we like. But someone said I did say one thing I said is there's about 10 companies on the floor that I really like. I could just quickly name those if that's of any interest to you, and it doesn't mean that they're all good. It certainly doesn't mean the others are all bad. But, you know, Atlantic Gold is a very cheap, well-financed company developing a project in Nova Scotia. Thank you. Which is a very, I think, recently underexplored or underdeveloped province. That's trading just a little over a dollar. Eurasian, Dave Cole spoke at the panel there. Eurasian is a company that is, again, a prospect generator, but trying to generate royalties from the prospects that they generate. It's had a bit of a turnaround. I mean, there was a lot of questions about whether they'd have to finance again and so on. But I think they've dodged that bullet with a couple of recent sales of projects they've done. So I like Eurasian. That trades US. EMXX is a symbol. Edward Mary X-ray. Under a dollar, I think, is a good buy. Cisco, I've mentioned. Metgold, I've mentioned. Midland, I've mentioned. That's one of my favorite. You know, if you don't own Midland, I would suggest you go to the booth and talk to them. They're great people. They've got a great balance sheet. They've got about $50 million in cash. They've got 7 projects on which they have joint ventures. So they're well diversified. The joint ventures are with good companies like Cisco, Agnico, Detour, and Jogmec, the Japanese Japanese company, mostly gold, but also uranium and rare earths. They also have some base metal projects that they haven't JV'd yet. So really great company, good diversification. What else? Millrock is a joint venture company. Alaska, BC, Stewart area, and Sonora in Mexico. And it's just a traditional prospect generator, very disciplined. They generate the prospects, they don't spend a lot of money, and they find partners to come in. You know, that's a slow business because the key always is, the difficulty, as Dave Cole said, is not so much generating prospects as in generating prospects that you think someone else wants to spend money on. And it's just a slow slog, but this company's been very, very disciplined at what they're doing. And they will be, basically, they're expecting next year, end of next year, going forward, to be self-financing with the fees that they're getting for managing the projects. So they have enough money to last them till next year. Then they'll be getting about $1 million a year, which is enough to run the company. So that's good. Millrock. Riverside, I didn't mention Riverside. That's another prospect generator. I like prospect generators because it lowers the risk. And they're primarily operating in Mexico. but they have a booth here, good people, good balance sheet. I think that's most of them. I mean, there are one or two others that I like. Mariana is a good company. They have 40% of a very, very attractive project in Turkey. Their partner is a Turkish company. It's a pure joint venture, meaning they have to spend 40% and the other people spend 60%. But when it comes time to raise the capital to put it into production, they will probably not raise the 40%. They will probably, you know, have the others raise the money and dilute down. But it's a good company, good balance sheet, good people. And I guess I should mention the last one on my list, which is Skeena. Skeena is, they have a booth down there. They have several projects up in British Columbia in this sort of Stewart area near where Pretium has its great deposit. And, you know, it's grassroots exploration, I think. They're spending a lot of money. They're raising money, spending money, but at least the money's going in the ground. You know, it's not going on fancy dinners, but, you know, exploration is very, very expensive. But I think they'll succeed. Yes? Well, that's sort of two different questions, if I may. Because I can, Midland, well, I'll answer the question. I think Medgold has as good a chance to go up tenfold, 10 times as anything. Skeena is a longer shot, I think. But if they're successful, you know, that could go up tenfold. It depends whether Ron Nedelisky decides to build it or not. But they're going to have to spend a lot of money on that project. But if they're lucky and if they're successful, that could easily go up tenfold. I don't think Atlantic or Eurasian will go up tenfold. Or Cisco won't go up tenfold. Midland probably won't go up tenfold, although the risk is a lot lower. The other one on my list I didn't mention was Prospero Silver. That could easily go up tenfold. Prospero, the symbol's PSL. You know, it's only like, hang on now, it's only like 3 million market cap. It's very, very small. I won't say it's a gamble, but if they're successful in what they're doing, they raised some money recently. We took part in a private placement. They raised some money recently specifically to do some drilling. It's in a very, very prospective area in Mexico. If they're successful, that could easily go up tenfold because it's just so, so thinly, you know, it's so small at the moment. But what? It's PSL, I don't know, .V, I don't know. I mean, when I trade, it's on, well, yeah, it's on the Junior Toronto, whatever they call it these days. Because it used to be Vancouver, but it's not anymore, is it? Venture, whatever, I don't know. Yes, sir. Do you have a question? Sorry. Oh, no, I think the ones I've just mentioned, it would all be based on the company itself. But, of course, if gold collapses or silver collapses, yeah, yeah. But, no, all of these would be based on the company doing doing something. I am going to have to go. No, no, thank you. And I don't like doing this, but I'm terribly late for my 8 o'clock. Don't forget, if anybody's interested in the fund that we do, that's this card up here, and then this is if you're interested in what we do.